Taking Stock with Vincent Wall.
Thanks to Skillnet Ireland, driving business success through innovative training and upskilling.
This is News Talk.
You're welcome to Taking Stock on News Talk. I'm Vincent Wall, and each week we take a wider view of some of the major shifts in the global economy and those closer to home. You can get in contact with us by emailing takingstock@newstalk.com or on Twitter at takingstocknt. Now, we're going to place a special focus today on the history of financial bubbles and economic crashes down through the years. We're joined first by John Turner, Professor of Finance and Financial History at Queen's University Belfast and co-author of Boom and Bust, A Global History of Financial Bubbles. John, you're very welcome and thank you for joining us.
No problem, Vincent.
This great book that you've written with your colleague William Quinn, you've roamed over far and wide over continents and centuries of some of the 10 big historical bubbles, some of which we've heard of, some of which we haven't. But I think you've challenged the notion we all have about financial bubbles, that it was down to the sheer irrationality of the investors who were duped at the time. I think you're challenging that, and you're saying there is a constant framework here, the bubble triangle that determines how all of these bubbles over time and over regions develop.
So the bubble triangle is really the central organizing theme of the book. And the bubble triangle is akin to the fire triangle in chemistry. So for a fire, you need heat, you need oxygen, and you need fuel, and then you need some sort of external spark to set it all off. And so it is with bubbles. And so what we observe with these bubbles across continents and across time, there's three constants. The first constant is speculation. So you see throughout these historical bubbles, lots of novices getting involved in buying, whether that be houses or whether that be property or whether that be stocks and shares. The second side of this bubble triangle is the fuel or the money and credit. So this is where, with low interest rates, people are reaching for yield. So they're reaching into riskier assets or buying riskier assets. And with credit, it's when we lower credit standards and it's cheap to borrow, then you get people actually borrowing to buy the bubble asset. Again, whether that be a house or whether that be stocks or shares. And then the third side of this bubble triangle is the oxygen. And this is the marketability of the underlying asset, the ease with which assets can be bought and sold. And over time, it's become a lot easier to buy and sell stocks on stock markets. It's become a lot easier to buy and sell property. And this increase in marketability is something that we really observe throughout time. So those are the three sides: speculation, marketability, money and credit. And then the external spark usually comes from politics, Vincent. That's usually the thing that sparks off these bubbles. A lot of the bubbles across history have been deliberately engineered by governments. Some have been sparked almost as an aside from other policies. And the other thing then that we've found that sparks some bubbles across time is new technology, radical new technology that we really don't know how it's going to affect the economy. But this technology gets us excited, and we start speculating in this new technology. So think internet shares, for example, back in the late 1990s. So that, in essence, is the bubble triangle that we outline in the book.
As you know, we on this island, particularly south of the border, John, are well used to boom and bust cycles and to all sorts of bubbles. But take our property bubble that we didn't suffer alone, obviously, 10, 12 years ago. Does that suggest that wasn't necessarily the fault of the banks, but ultimately driven by political policy that drove interest rates and other dynamics behind that?
Yeah. Yes. So one of the chapters in the book is the subprime bubble. And in that bubble, we look with Ireland, north and south, because in the north, we had a similar sort of a boom and bust as you had in the south. We look at the UK, we look at Spain, and look at the United States. And we ask, well, what was the common feature amongst these four economies that had these large housing booms and busts and then suffered tremendous banking crises after that? And the one thing that links these four industrial democracies, it was their attitude towards how you provide social housing. In the rest of Europe and the rest of sort of the industrial world, social housing is largely provided by the state. But in these four economies, the decision was taken, you know, back in the 1980s and into the 1990s, that to help the bottom quintiles of society, you know, get their own house, we're going to deregulate the financial system and encourage the financial system, and in some cases almost force the financial system to lend to low-income borrowers so that they can get onto the housing market. So pressure comes on banks to lower their loan-to-asset values, to lower their loan-to-income ratios that they usually operated on. And so you get this tremendous drop in credit standards in the US, in Spain, in Ireland, in the UK, and that really then is what's driving it. So it's a political decision about how we want to provide social housing. And it's also got behind it this idea of, you know, the great inequality that we see in sort of Western democracies that's emerged over the past 20, 30 years. And our politicians thought that one way of trying to deal with that was to actually get more people to be property owners. And these four governments got addicted to the property boom that they experienced because, you know, property developers are paying taxes, banks are paying taxes, construction industry is paying taxes, and these, you know, the governments in these economies then are living off really high GDP, all the taxes coming in, and then they're able to fund, you know, things like education and health and other social goods as well.
Fascinating insights there into how the property and the housing bubble in particular developed in those jurisdictions, including our own, John, and let's hope we learn lessons from it. But looking back over all the bubbles that you've examined and you've set the necessary ingredients there and then the triggers that set them off, into all of that combustible kind of mix comes the impact of the media as well.
Yeah. Yeah, the fourth estate. So it's really interesting when we look across these bubbles, the role of the media, because it ultimately depends on the incentives of the media. So in some of the bubbles we look at, you see newspapers wanting to develop them or sell themselves as having this reputation of being a purveyor of truth, an exposer of financial folly. So you see that in the 19th century, particularly with the likes of The Times or The Economist, when they were speaking out against something called the railway mania, which took place in the mid-1840s in the UK. And they had these large anti-bubble editorials going on. So they were really calling the bubbles and trying to prick the bubbles, if you like. Then sometimes, some of the bubbles, we observe venal journalism. And we particularly observe this when there's state control of the press. So one of the first bubbles we look at in the book is this Mississippi bubble, which took place in 1720. And despite the name, it actually took place in Paris. And the name of the company that people were speculating was the Mississippi Company. But the French press, the Parisian press, was state controlled. And it was basically puffing, you know, this bubble so that people would buy shares in this Mississippi company. And then more recently in China, so we have a chapter on the book on China, looking at bubbles in China in 2007 and 2015. And there again, the state controls the press, and the state were using the press to really push the bubbles and to push a bubble narrative. And then we also observe bubbles where the press's business model is being driven by advertising the bubble asset. So you typically find this in property bubbles. So one of the bubbles we look at is set in Australia in the 1880s. And again, the press play a huge role in driving this property bubble because they're carrying advertisements from property developers and people selling plots of land. And when you look at Ireland in the 2000s, you look at the UK, you look at Spain, you look at the United States, you see a lot of local newspapers, their business model, essentially because of the internet, had changed to carrying advertisements for, you know, property developers, carrying advertisements for house sales. And so those newspapers had no incentive to actually call the bubble and to call it out. And so it ultimately depends on the incentives that the press faces at the time of the bubble.
Yeah, property pornography, I think we termed it about 10 or 12 years ago. Our guest here on News Talk is John Turner, co-author of Boom and Bust, A Global History of Financial Bubbles. You range back as far as the one I think we all heard from in our school days, the South Sea Bubble, John, but you burst a bubble that I think many of us also have heard of in some way, and we thought it was quite an exotic bubble, the tulip bubble of, what, 1636, 1637 in Holland, which perhaps wasn't a bubble in the strict sense at all.
Yeah, so as you say, most people, when you mention the word bubble, possibly the first thing they think of is what was called the tulip mania, which took place in Holland in 1636. But when you actually look at this bubble, which was a bubble surrounding the exotic tulip bulbs, people buying and selling exotic tulip bulbs, there's very little evidence that this bubble actually took place. What was happening in Amsterdam at the time is that there were some people who thought that people paying high prices for these exotic tulip bulbs, this was just excessive. This was not right to do this. This was inappropriate. And so then you get these sort of satirical pieces being written about people paying high prices for these tulip bulbs. And then these satirical pieces are picked up by later authors, and they're misreported. They don't realize that it's satire, and so they report it as fact. And then into the English language, it comes in a famous book in 1843 was published, which basically really brings this tulip mania to the English-speaking world. And it's based on no evidence whatsoever, or very little evidence. And so that's the way it's come into the English language. And unfortunately, then every time there's a bubble, people talk about the tulips. So we totally dismiss this as even being a bubble in the book.
Well, let's hope the early media in Holland and since then weren't involved in fanning a mythological story. The book ranges over a whole range of fascinating bubbles from the South Sea bubble, as we said, through an Australian land boom bubble in the 19th century to the recent Chinese stock market bubbles. But one I had never heard of, at least, the British bicycle bubble of the 1890s.
Yeah, this is a fascinating bubble. So we think that what really sparked this bubble was radical new technology, and that radical new technology was the bicycle, the modern bicycle. So even by the 1880s, people were still riding the old penny farthing, the ridiculous bike with this huge front wheel, tiny rear wheel. And of course, it was notorious for accidents. People were so-called taking a header where you would come off this bicycle. There was also the bone shaker bicycle, so named because it shook every single bone in the human body. But in the late 1880s, we get the emergence of lots of new technology that allows the modern bicycle, the bicycle that we would recognize today, to emerge. So some of these things are the diamond frame, a chain, and pneumatic tires. And you put all of these three important things together and a bunch of other important technological inventions, then you've got this amazing new technology. And so round about the mid-1890s, you then get hundreds of bicycle manufacturers, mainly based in Birmingham and Coventry, but some based in Dublin, floating on the London Stock Exchange, raising capital in the London Stock Exchange to basically set up bicycle companies. So by the peak of the bubble in 1896, you have something like 600 plus bicycle companies listed on the London Stock Exchange and the Birmingham Stock Exchange and other stock exchanges around the UK. And the prices of these bicycle shares doubles in the space of a year. And then once the bubble collapses, roughly about 1896, 97, bicycle shares collapse in price. So this is like an episode that most people haven't heard of. It's also an episode that we go on to describe as being a useful bubble, because not all bubbles are destructive. This was one example of a useful bubble because a lot of the technology that was developed by these bicycle companies ends up in motorcycle companies, ends up in motor cars. So a lot of the technology that these companies develop ends up in motor cars, and it even ends up in aeroplanes. Most people don't realize that the Wright brothers actually started off as bicycle manufacturers.
You say that not all bubbles are destructive, but we know that, and we know that some people actually make money from the mania that starts at the start of the cycle, get in and out, whether through good judgment or otherwise. But broadly speaking, these forms of bubbles are not good for economies or for the citizens who people those economies, John.
Yeah. Again, one of the things we try and do in the book is try and understand what makes some bubbles more destructive than others. And there's two things that come together to make for various destructive bubbles in terms of destroying economic growth and destroying economies and destroying individuals' lives. And that's when the bubble is sparked by or engineered by governments, and when the banking system is heavily involved, when the banking system is lending money to help buy the bubble assets. So you think of the subprime bubble. So in the US, the UK, Ireland, Spain, you think of the Australian property bubble, which took place in the 1880s. This is the burst that, that Australia had after their property bubble lasted for, you know, the depression lasted for like nearly two decades. It's the worst economic experience Australia has ever had in its history. Japan's another example. Its property and stock market bubble burst in 1990. And I remember as a student in 1990, people saying, oh, Japan's this wonderful place. And then I'm a lecturer by the year 2000. And, you know, we're talking about the lost decade in Japan. And then by the time we get to 2010, we're talking about the lost two decades in Japan because, you know, the destructive nature of its bubble. So, yeah, bubbles can be very destructive. But the two common themes that we find, you know, politics and banks.
Are we getting any better at predicting when these will happen, John, including with the help of your book? Or given, as you said earlier, that markets are becoming much more swift and prompt, and I suppose the impact of social media in terms of spreading rumour and all sorts of information, are we likely to see more and more of them?
Yeah, so one of the things we have observed in the book is that the time span between the first major bubble in the world and the second was almost 100 years. And then after that, the time between different bubbles shortened and shortened and shortened to the extent now that when we hit the 1990s, we're seeing a bubble, a major bubble in the economy every 6 to 7 years. So they are getting a lot more frequent. Now, are bubbles easy to predict? No. So this is one of the things that we spend a lot of time in the conclusion of the book talking, can we predict bubbles? And indeed, the most common question that I'm asked when people find out that I've written this book is, you know, when's the next bubble going to happen? How can we predict it? And so the answer that we normally give, or I normally give to that question, is, you know, going back to the three sides of the bubble triangle. Is there easy marketability? Is there a lot of, you know, marketability in the shares or in property? Is there a lot of speculation? Do we see a lot of novices entering the market? And then is it, what about money and credit? Are interest rates low? Is lending lax? So if I was looking at the market today, I would say marketability is very high because we've got fractional shares. So you want to buy a Tesla share today, you can buy a fraction of that through most stockbrokers. We've got zero commission with online brokers, so you don't have to pay to trade. We've got rampant speculation. This is particularly the case in the United States, but it's also the case in countries like India and China, where you've got a lot of people, because of lockdown, a lot of millennials becoming day traders. And they're not only just trading stocks and shares, they're trading options. And then we've got really low interest rates today. You know, we're at the zero lower bound. People can borrow to invest in the stock markets. People are reaching for yield. And so the three sides are present. We just need a spark. And these sparks are really difficult to predict. These are the unpredictable things. And this is where we hope the likes of my book and the likes of other new mental models help us try and figure out if there's a bubble around the corner, Vincent.
Caveat emptor, we have been warned. Fascinating stuff indeed. That was John Turner, Professor of Finance and Financial History at Queen's University Belfast and co-author of Boom and Bust, A Global History of Financial Bubbles. John, thanks indeed for joining us.
Thanks very much, Vincent, for having me.
This is Vincent Wall with you on News Talks Taking Stock. We'll hear next from Thomas Levinson, Professor of Science Writing at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and author of Money for Nothing, The Scientists, Fraudsters and Corrupt Politicians Who Reinvented Money, Panicked a Nation and Made the World Rich. Tom, you're very welcome. Thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Well, that's an absolutely fantastic and hugely attractive title in its own right, Tom. Who wouldn't open the pages with a title like that? And it could be something as recent as the great crash of 10 years ago, but you're actually bringing us back to the early 18th century in England, 1720 being the critical year with the South Sea Bubble, as it was called, which we'll tease out in just a moment. But the events of that year and around it actually grew from a lot of changes to mathematics and research that was happening from the mid-17th century onwards in England.
That's right. I mean, one of the things that I really hope to bring forward in this book is that things that happen in daily life, like buying, you know, getting and spending and all that, are connected to profound changes in ideas that occur as human beings discover new things. And the thing that people in Europe and England and Ireland, in fact, plays a significant role in this story. The thing that they were discovering in the mid 17th century was that you can use mathematics to organize your thinking about the future in ways that people had really never done before. And that was, you know, that's one of the really big changes in the way people get through the day, as well as discover, you know, fantastic things in outer space and so forth.
And this emerged from a whole new spirit of inquiry that was bursting forth, I suppose, not only in England, but across Europe from the mid 17th century onwards, to look behind things and to get greater value out of things and to measure things. And the likes of Isaac Newton and Halley, who discovered the comet, principal exponents of that new spirit of research, enlightenment and innovation.
That's right. I mean, we call what was happening in Europe in the latter half of the 17th century the scientific revolution. I mean, that's something that, you know, we all heard about in school and so forth. And usually people think of, I think people, when you say the word scientific revolution, you think about, you know, the famous figures like Newton and Halley, as you mentioned, and Huygens in the Netherlands and Leibniz in Germany and all that sort of stuff, doing fancy things with mathematics and studying, you know, the flight of the planets or how to do, you know, perspective painting or design a shipwright, all those kinds of things. But it turns out that when you look deeply into the mathematical ideas that they were developing from you know, the mid-17th century and even a little bit before that, through the end of the century, an awful lot of that has to do with two big concepts. One, can you think about the future in terms of risk? And can you quantify risk? Can you do mathematics about risk to decide, you know, everything is from, you know, things as mundane as actually a question Newton himself answered for a friend of his, which is how to bet on a game of dice, but to much more profound things. How do you think about a piece of land you might want to buy, not as a piece of land that you just sort of own as a physical thing, but as a stream of activity that occurs with that land over years or decades to come? And if you do think about it that way, how do you price it? So that's one thing, risk and ideas about the future in that sense, but also straight out prediction. I mean, what Newton did when he invented his laws of motion, when he discovered them, is he came up not just with specific results, but a way of thinking that said, if I know certain parameters now, I can predict deterministically with very, you know, great sense of confidence and accuracy where Jupiter will be in 100 years or where Halley's comet will be in 75 years back in our night sky, 76 years actually, that kind of thing. So those seemingly abstract mathematical ideas about infinite series and infinitesimals and all these kinds of things that you learn and then many of us forget in school. It turns out they aren't just sort of abstract reasoning. They're intimately, directly, daily connected in a deep way to the way we move through the world on our daily business.
And how does this environment of investigation and research and modeling, with many practical consequences, including the world of money, both present and future, how does that lead us into the environment from which the South Sea Company was established in the early 18th century in England?
Well, you know, you're absolutely right that from the very beginning of this change in intellectual capacity, intellectual ambition in the 17th century, people like, the members of the Royal Society in London were intimately concerned with practical affairs as well as with abstract natural philosophy, as it was called back then. So you had people, you know, trying to do all kind. Halley was involved in life insurance, and Newton was actually the manager of a metalworking shop, in effect, as master of the Royal Mint. So these were very, very practical people. And they were doing this practical work informed by mathematics at a time when England and then Britain, after the Acts of Union, was building the first true national debt in the sort of fiscal history of Europe. It started, you know, this debt started accumulating as England started fighting wars it basically couldn't afford with France in the late 17th century, wars that continued with interruptions really till 1815. This was the start of what's called often the long century, long 18th century. And as Britain tried to, you know, really expand its reach as a trading nation and as a you know, burgeoning empire, this is a very expensive activity, and it used new ideas about how to raise money, creating kinds of government bonds and a whole variety of financial instruments, all of which we're now familiar with today, but which were brand new back then, to fund its growing operations, the growing, you know, national aspiration. And the problem with all that debt is particularly as it was first created, is there was this huge, first of all, it was very large relative to the amount of revenue the British state actually could command. And it was cumbersome, illiquid, had all kinds of just, you know, they were experimenting with new ways to raise money. So they tried everything. And that meant that after a very few years, they had this sort of enormous portfolio of clunky, difficult to manage stuff. And the South Sea Company emerged in that context as a way to try and rationalize this growing mountain of obligations. And the way it was going to do that, and really it was founded in 1711, and the way the South Sea Company sort of set out to do this was basically take different bits of the new national debt and turn it into South Sea Company equity, which then became just this sort of common liquid thing you could buy and sell on the also then new London Stock Exchange, and you know, create a more manageable approach to both raising money and then manipulating it crucially in perhaps the other great innovation of Britain's early fiscal state, the idea of a secondary market in government obligations.
So was the South Sea Company a government-sponsored idea by which it could actually park its growing debt, or was it entrepreneurs, some of them perhaps a little bit like wide boys of the 18th century, who set it up?
The answer to your question is yes. It was actually a bit of both of those. The people behind the South Sea Company were part of what Daniel Defoe would later call a triumvirate of thieves or thieving. So there were these quite, you know, dodgy promoters who wanted to get rich off trading in government paper. But it was also something that the government really set out to do. I mean, South Sea Company itself was born in part of party politics. The Whigs had been in charge of the British government for several years, and the Bank of England, which was, you know, founded quite recently, was associated with the Whigs. And in 1711, there was a lot of political turmoil. The Tories came in, and in part, the South Sea Company was there to act as a counterweight to what they saw as, you know, a Whig-led organization. But, you know, aside from the party politics, it was just a matter of there was this enormous and really variegated pile of debt with interest payments that were, you know, as half or more of sort of the peacetime annual revenue of the government. And it was clearly going to be intractable. And if, you know, if there wasn't peace, if they had to raise more money at war, it was going to be difficult under those circumstances to do so. So the idea was to try and figure out how to bring at least some part of the debt under control. And the South Sea Company was founded to do that. And it was founded in an interesting way. The idea is that it was, yes, it was going to serve a public finance function by taking in government debt and sort of injecting that debt into the stock market in the form of South Sea stock. But the company needed, or at least thought it needed, some kind of activity to capitalize all that financial transactions. And so it was set up as a monopoly trading company as well as a kind of quasi-banking operation, with a monopoly on trade to the Spanish ports of Spanish Latin America.
A bit like the East India Company, which we've covered before for South America. But tell us, Tom, how I can see the advantage for the British state in being able to clean up a lot of its growing debt and parking it into this organization that it would pay a lower interest rate to, I presume. I can see the advantage for the promoters of the South Sea Company itself in taking that debt on and being able to issue new shares to counteract it. Why did it become such a crazy bubble in the year of 1720?
Well, what happened in 17, the proposition was always that if you were a debt holder and you had this instrument that was paying you 7, 8, 9% a year, the advantage was you got an outsized interest payment above market rates, and you got it for often very long terms. But the problem with it is it was illiquid. You couldn't sell it on. They weren't transferable. So if you wanted, you know, your principal out, you couldn't get it. And what the South Sea Company offered was two things to these to the punters, which was it could you could sell the stock on the open market and thus get your principal out, and you could take part in what was suggested would be, as you said, an East India Company style monopoly trading company that could produce, you know, riches beyond the dream of avarice. So you could participate in growth, and if you actually needed your cash in hand, you could get it. And that was a very attractive deal to a lot of people. And in 1720, what happened was the government of the day agreed with the principals of the South Sea Company, the leaders of it, to allow them to absorb not just, you know, the one loan or another, one set of financial paper or another, but essentially the entire body of British debt. It's upwards of, you know, 30 to 40 million pounds, which you multiply that by a very large number to express that in 21st century terms. Huge pile of debt. And they did so on terms that were very advantageous to the company. Most importantly, the company was allowed to value its stock. You know, the prices, the price they should pay for the for each piece of debt. A long-term debt was worth, you know, £100 return was worth £2,700 or something. There was an agreed set number to convert debt into stock. But what was left open was what value the stock would have. Didn't have to be the par value. It could be whatever the market would bear. And this did two things. It made the stock, the shares of anyone who already held South Sea stock much, much more valuable. It made early entrance into the stock on the New Deal very, very valuable. And it gave the sense going forward as the South Sea Company retained some part of its shares, you know, as it accumulated more and more capital, as people poured more money into it, poured more debt into it, it made the company itself look, on paper, vastly larger and vastly richer. So those are the conditions in which people can say, hey, this is a great deal. I have to rush to get my debt in there. And all of a sudden, you had this sort of self-feeding frenzy as each new offer to take in debt went out at a higher price. That higher price, if it was subscribed to quickly, which it was through four different iterations from April to August, everybody rushed in. The subscriptions were filled in hours or a day or two at most. People, you know, very, very smart people like Isaac Newton himself, ran. They did not walk. They ran to South Sea offices to hand over their safe, secure, boring government bonds to get in on this high-flying South Sea stock. And every time they did so, the South Sea Company appeared to be more valuable. The only problem was, of course, and this is where the bubble comes in, is that only works as long as the market agrees on that value. And once it becomes clear that to somebody, to enough people, that the prices people are willing to accept for their debt, the value of the shares, the number of shares that they're willing to accept, cannot sustain the returns people are imagining, or even match the returns of the debt that they're handing over to buy this stock. Once that becomes clear to enough people, of course, the entire thing goes away. This company ceases to appear valuable. If it ceases to appear valuable, it ceases to be valuable, and people run for the doors.
Our guest here on News Talks Taking Stock is Thomas Levinson, author of the wonderfully titled Money for Nothing, The Scientists, Fraudsters, and Corrupt Politicians Who Reinvented Money, Panicked a Nation, and Made the World Rich. So in the course of 1720, basically the stock or share price of the South Sea Company absolutely ballooned. The great and the good, the wealthy and the not so wealthy all got in thinking it was a good thing. And as we are so much more familiar with in modern days, Tom, by the autumn of that year, It appeared for what it was, a bubble, and people tried to get out and went to the government looking to be bailed out, another expression we're pretty familiar with here.
Indeed they did. In January 1720, South Sea stock was in the low 100s. By December it was in the low 100s, but in between it had gotten up to 1,000. So there was a precipitous rise and even more precipitous fall. And yeah, almost as soon as it became apparent that that people had invested enormous amounts of dull but valuable assets into this thing that turned out to be wildly overpriced, they went to seeking help. And you know, the argument was in part, you know, this thing was set up by the government, it was chartered by the government, and it was, and it serves the government function. It helped the government take care of its debt. So what we really want is to just, I mean, one leading member of parliament led a group that said, just undo the whole thing, erase all the bargains, go back to, you know, the status quo ante of last January, and we'll start again. And in this plea, they were completely unsuccessful. And in that refusal to accept a reversion to the prior circumstances, the new leadership of the British government essentially created the fabric, the scaffolding, at least, of what has become modern national finance.
And that was under the first effective Prime Minister of Great Britain, Robert Walpole. How did his refusal to bail out the great and the good, including the King's mistresses, I'm told, how did his refusal to bail them out actually lead to a near modern capitalist system, and in particular a system for efficient use of government debt?
What Walpole said was, you know, we'll claw back whatever money we can from the fraudsters who were behind this. He was perhaps overly eager there in some cases, but he would undo none of the bargains, because, you know, leave aside the turmoil in the marketplace and all that, the South Sea bubble worked. You know, the South Sea deal actually did exactly what the government wanted it to do. It took this, you know, almost all of, you know, Britain's long-term debt and much of its floating debt, its shorter-term obligations, turned it into South Sea shares with an agreed interest rate and a secondary market where people could buy and sell these shares, and you know, made it easy using that vehicle or other vehicles like that to offer new borrowing going forward. And Walpole said, we're not undoing any of that. We'll take back the fortunes of Defoe's, you know, triumvir of thieves and all that sort of stuff, and we'll put that into the kitty to help ease the pain. But we like having what was increasingly understood to be a liquid, abstract, functioning bond market. I mean, the simplest way to say what happened out of the South Sea bubble is that between 1720 and the early 1750s, successive prime ministers, Walpole for most of that period, and then his successors, Pelham being the critical person at the end of the period, basically turned all of Britain's borrowing into either short-term floating notes or perpetual bonds that could be bought and sold and paid interest, and could be redeemed as the British government had enough money to buy the stuff back. And, you know, creating, and the most important thing is that all of these instruments were essentially the same thing. It was, you know, an institutionalization of the idea that, at least as far as government borrowing went, credit became a form of money. The Treasury could raise £1 million to go fight in Antigua or wherever the Empire was taking them next. Those would be issued as South Sea shares or what became consolidated bonds, the famous consols, these kinds of things. And every £100 of a consol was the same as every other £100. If the British government was doing well and the interest rates were secure, it might be worth on the open market £105. If there was some fear that there might be some risk going in there, it might be sold for £98. But it didn't matter. You could buy them from the Treasury, you could sell them on Exchange Alley in London, and you could, you know, hand them to somebody and say, this is worth £100. And most often, if they were financially sophisticated, they'd accept it. It played all the functions of money with the additional feature that it paid interest and was essentially, its price on the secondary market, in fact, was the measure of people's ideas about how the future was looking for the British state.
And that mechanism effectively not only went on to fund the growing British Empire, which we're all aware of, but I suppose it's that element of your title, and made the world rich, that it set up processes whereby governments could borrow in a consistent and regular way to fund either economic growth or wars or whatever.
That's right. I mean, for Britain, for most of the 18th century, this innovation of a reliable, liquid market for debt, for credit, was reserved for government use. And it mostly funded government ambitions. There was private borrowing, but the banking system in Britain was turned much, you know, was the financial system in Britain as it evolved originally was turned much more to government ends. In the colonies in America, this was a very contentious thing because it really constrained American economic growth. And as soon as the American colonies broke away and formed the United States, the rules that regulated who had access to equity and debt markets shifted enormously in favor of private enterprise. So you saw the colonies in America were a relatively economically poor outpost of Britain in 1760. And by 1810 or 20, the growth was enormous. It hadn't caught up with Britain yet, but was growing at a much faster rate than the home country, the mother country. And you were seeing these credit markets being used to fund all kinds of and equity markets both to fund all kinds of economic activity. The post-revolution boom that a lot of people have written about. And, you know, it turns out that when you give people a way to make a bet on the future with the sort of cultural apparatus, but also in some ways the scientific, the mathematical, abstract reasoning to think about what an investment should be worth and how much you should pay for it, and start to think in systematic ways about the future quantified in money. It turns out you can pay for a lot of hamburgers today by promising to pay on Tuesday, the old wimpy line. It took a while. I mean, Britain took note of what America was doing and changed its banking laws in the early 19th century and saw an equivalent boom. It had a great impact on Britain. And now these techniques, of course, have spread all over the world. And to me, one of the most interesting things, as we see, early modern finance turning into modern financial capitalism, is not only have the advantages of being able in sort of rigorous and systematic ways to price the future and price risk in the future into present day calculations, the price you will pay on, the Dublin market, the London market, the New York market, and so forth. We've also, without really paying anywhere near enough attention to it, also imported the flaws that the South Sea bubble itself showed. We've got both the power, the wealth that flows from the use of finance, and the sort of structural danger of financial collapse. And these were dangers that were evident in 1720, that were first really fully seen in 1720 in crashes actually in London and in Paris and in Amsterdam. There was a Europe-wide sort of epidemic of this kind of early financial craze and crash. But when de Tocqueville came to the U.S. in the early 19th century and wrote his famous Democracy in America, he noted that this system of entrepreneurship funded by credit produced this incredible dense network of interconnection and thus interconnected risk that could, pose a huge danger of not just, if a single business fails, it's not just them, it's lots and lots and lots of follow-on effects. And we certainly saw that in 2007, 8, 9. I think we're seeing it, or we'll see it increasingly with the COVID-related economic distress we're seeing, unless governments are really, really proactive. And that, to me, is the big lesson of the bubble, and I hope of the book. The book is almost entirely set in historical periods. There's just a little epilogue about that early 21st century crash. But the thing is, we know that there are structural weaknesses in financial capitalism. We've seen them. They've recurred over and over again in devastating disasters that produce, great human suffering, loss of human potential, blighted lives, and so forth. And the thing is, that what causes them and how they develop, we can't predict when such a crash will happen, but we can, you know, look at the forces that are present in each of the prior crashes and see if those forces are present today, which unfortunately often they are.
And finally, Tom, you mentioned at the start that Ireland played a significant role in the whole South Sea bubble. Briefly, what was it?
Well, it played at least two roles. One was in the development of early ideas about quantification and experience. Ireland was a bitter, brutal, misery-infused test case. In the Cromwellian reconquest of Ireland in around 1650, that expedition, that military expedition, was funded basically by promising the troops and so-called adventurers, people who loaned money to the Parliament to fund the expedition. They were promised basically all of Ireland as their payback. And after the conquest, somebody had to figure out, you know, what was Ireland worth? You know, what was each little, you know, acre and stone and building worth? And how could you divide up and how to divide it up systematically? So that if somebody was promised, you know, £1,000 worth of Ireland, they got their £1,000. And the attempt to serve it, that led to one of the early great attempts to survey and do an economic and demographic systematic accounting for, you know, a whole country. And it turned out that the person who actually solved the problem of doing it, it's a very difficult problem in many ways, created something called the Down Survey, which has, you know, the records of that are stored at Trinity College Dublin. It's a fabulous website. You can go look at the maps there. You know, I recommend that to all the listeners. But basically, this guy went in and created a systematic, almost Henry Ford-like assembly line of measures to value all of Ireland. And that valuation was, the guy who did that was a man named William Petty, who was also one of the founders of the Royal Society. And out of that experience created something called political arithmetic, which is one of the earliest ways to try and use quantification and measurement to design government policy. So Ireland was a test case, and you know, the outcome of the survey, the practical outcome of the survey, was the dispossession of much of the Irish living in Ireland at the time, dispossessing them of their land and transferring it to various English soldiers or investors back in the back in London and throughout England. But it also led Petty, you know, Petty was paid himself in thousands of acres of Irish land, and for much of the rest of his career promoted a series of just horrific proposals, none of which were enacted, fortunately, to transform Ireland into essentially a British plantation. In some cases, he proposed even depopulating the entire island. You know, it's a really grim part of that history. Ireland had plenty of investors in the South Sea bubble. There's actually a whole separate subfield of study of who invested and how much they lost and what the elites then did to fix it, which wasn't very much.
Fascinating story indeed, but we leave it there. That's Thomas Levinson, Professor of Science Writing at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and author of Money for Nothing, The Scientists, Fraudsters and Corrupt Politicians Who Reinvented Money, Panicked a Nation and Made the World Rich. Tom, thanks indeed for joining us.
Thank you. It's been lovely talking with you.
Taking Stock on News Talk.
Thanks to Skillnet Ireland, driving business success through innovative training and upskilling.